As the world changes, so does trade.
There is a view that is becoming increasingly common that because this is a geopolitical world, it's like a zero-sum game. So whatever my rival is gaining, it's my loss. And then in this world, there is no need for cooperation. Now, that's clearly an incorrect view of the world.
Michele Ruta is the IMF's trade expert and tracks how a shift in one country's trade policy can have global repercussions.
Even when there are geopolitical tensions and geopolitical rivalry, there is still a role for cooperation. And the role for cooperation is clearly there because the policies that countries are imposing on others reduce efficiency, which at the end of the day hurts everybody.
So things are happening so fast in the global economy and at so many levels, and trade is always at the core of economic activity. What are the big changes in trade that stand out for you these days, and how do you see that playing out in the global economy?
So there are three big shifts that are in part related one to the other that we are observing today, and they really affect the trade landscape. The first ones are the structural shifts. These are things like climate change, technology. They matter because they can change the comparative advantage of countries. These are the products that countries specialize in and export, and that have a big impact on their growth prospects. The second type of shift is the policy shift. Here, what we are observing is especially the return of industrial policy. We talked about it in a previous podcast.
Yeah.
And this is quite impressive in terms of numbers, and I can get to that a bit later. Mm-hmm. And then the third shift is the geopolitical shifts. These are the tensions that emerge for geopolitical reasons among countries. Obviously, the US and China rivalry is always big in the news. And this, again, can impact the trade landscape. And in fact, the fund has been talking quite a bit about the risks of geoeconomic fragmentation.
Right.
Now, these are important because these shifts are happening at the same time, and they're going to affect the trade landscape in the coming years. And as a result, this landscape will likely be very different from what we had since the early 1990s.
Oh, okay. So let's break that down a little bit. So one of the big shifts that we're seeing in economic activity is from goods to services. What does that mean for trade?
So let me try to summarize 200 years of trade history in 20 seconds. If you go back to the 1800s, technological innovations in the shipping industry led to a reduction of travel times and travel costs. This allowed goods to cross borders, mm-hmm, and basically created the first wave of globalization. Now, fast forward to the 1980s, we had the information and communication technology revolution. This allowed, in the word of economist Richard Baldwin, to have factories that would cross borders. This has been the surge in global value chains and in trade in intermediate goods. Now, today we may be on the brink of the digital revolution. And the digital revolution mostly will affect services. And the reason is because it reduces the cost of face-to-face interaction. Let me give you an example. The podcast that you do, you don't sell it, but it's a service.
That's right.
And people can listen to it even if they are not in the room with us right now.
Yeah.
And similarly, this can be true for services that architects, copy editors, doctors. So the fact that there is this type of innovation may most likely impact services trade. Now, we see a little bit of these shifts already in the data. So if we think about globalization, The Economist famously put it as globalization because trade is not growing as it used to. But this really relates to goods trade. Services trade has been much more dynamic, mm-hmm, and especially digital services have been growing very, very fast. In the past 20 years, there's been roughly 8% per year. So that's really, in some sense, happening, and it has implications. It has implications for countries, especially developing countries, that can specialize in the exports of these services. And it has implications because when there is somebody that gains a comparative advantage, somebody else loses it. So it will affect jobs in other countries.
And you talk about digitalization. Artificial intelligence or AI is basically a game changer for many sectors and for the labor market across the globe. Does AI risk disrupting trade to the extent that it has labor?
So I think the way you ask the question is the right one. The key word is disruption. It's not destruction. And there is a difference between the two. Many people jump to the conclusions that artificial intelligence, and the same applies to other new technologies, robots or 3D printing, that they will substitute labor. And right. Because they substitute labor, they will eliminate or reduce the comparative advantage of developing countries which are labor abundant. Now, there is some of that that is going on and will happen. But I think there are other reasons to think that artificial intelligence, and by the way, I have no idea if it will be as revolutionary as people say, but one conjecture that I feel like I could make is that to the extent that it is, it will be revolutionary, it will also lead to more trade and more integration. So let me say why I make this point. The first is that we think of AI as substituting labor, but AI can also complement labor. And this means that it will increase the productivity of labor. And this will happen. And so for the countries and the sectors that will be early adopters, we'll see an increase in productivity and competitiveness, and therefore an increase in exports.
Okay.
Another element that very often people forget is that when you have increases in productivity and sectors that grow, those sectors rely on inputs which very often are imported. So as this productivity and this growth takes place, there are many services and goods that will be imported and so will come from other countries and will boost trade. Third element that people tend to forget is that artificial intelligence, to the extent that will make everyone more productive, it will also lead to higher growth. Higher growth comes with higher demand, and increases in demand very often result in increases in trade, because the goods that we and the services that we consume very often come from other countries. And then finally, there are many applications of artificial intelligence that could improve the functioning of global supply chains, can make trade cross-border more easily because they will improve the functioning of customs. So I think there are all these various elements that are there that will play out. So not just the trade destruction part, but the trade disruption, because obviously there will be effects on the comparative advantage that will shift production and exports from one country to the other.
So you can see some potential, not necessarily only in advanced economies, but in low-income countries as well, that are looking to develop their value chains and et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we spoke about industrial policy, as you mentioned earlier, a few months ago, earlier this year, and it was much about how the fund, the IMF, is working with other institutions on developing this database to help better understand the impact of today's industrial policy. So maybe first, just a quick refresher on what industrial policy is, perhaps, and then what we found, like what you've learned from that exercise and where it's all going, you think.
Yeah, so there is no single definition of industrial policy, but most people have in mind policies that are targeted to specific sectors of the economy, or could even be to specific firms. Now, with the Global Trade Alert, we have been recording industrial policies since January 2023. And the numbers are pretty astonishing. Mm-hmm. So if I looked at the data just before coming here for this podcast, we have roughly 4,000 measures that have been imposed worldwide. These measures are there for a number of reasons. competitiveness and climate change-related goals are roughly half of the reasons that at least governments state. Mm-hmm. There is also geopolitical concerns, including national security, that are a close third. And both the climate and geopolitical motivations are very prominent, especially in advanced economy. Another thing that comes out from the data is that most of these measures can distort trade flows, and this is something to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. Subsidies are the main tool of intervention. Increasingly, there are localization measures, what are called localization measures, like local content requirements. These are measures that basically tell you who you can buy from, or increasingly also screening of and restrictions of FDI, of foreign direct investment. Now, the second point that I would like to make on industrial policy that I discussed more extensively in the previous podcast is that the bar to get industrial policy right is actually high. Mm. Industrial policies are there for a reason, or can be there for a reason. Essentially, we may be concerned about market failures, and then governments want to step in and allocate resources to address these market failures. And
to bolster their own companies.
Exactly, because they essentially assess that their own companies, for instance, are not investing enough on certain products, which could be, for instance, environmentally friendly technologies, as an example, mm-hmm. where we will worry about market failures. At the same time, there are two big concerns. One is that as there are market failures, there can be government failures. These are things like corruption, rent-seeking, the funds, instead of going where they should go for economic reasons, they go to France. I think Martin Wolf in the Financial Times put it very nicely. He said, you know, governments can fail to pick winners, but losers are very likely to pick governments. Mm-hmm. And I think in our research, we have evidence that shows that this is a big concern. The second concern with industrial policy is that governments may not only react to the market failures that they observe, but also to the policies that other governments enact. And this is the reason is that there are spillovers from industrial policies through trade, and then governments react by imposing their own policies. So here you have what is called a tit for tat and the risk of escalation, which again can lead to inefficiency. So to make a long story short, design of industrial policy is very important. Now, the very last point relates to what we have been discussing so far on technology and services. Now, there is this argument out there that some people have made, and we see some evidence of it, that the opportunities for growth, especially for developing economies, will be by specializing in services exports. Now, if you think about that, the logical consequences is that governments, what they should focus on are things like education. You would want to have the right skills. Second, you want to focus on infrastructure. You need internet access in order to sell these services to other countries. Third, other infrastructures would be electricity. You need a stable system. If the power goes out, obviously it would be very disruptive if you're in the middle of selling your services abroad. Now, all these things are basically horizontal policies, are not industrial policies.
Hmm. So just to understand this, what might be considered industrial policy or constructive industrial policy is not necessarily industrial policy. It's just, you know, investing in infrastructure that's vital to growing the economy.
Correct. And those are generally defined as horizontal policies, mm-hmm. because they don't target a specific sector of the economy, but lift all the boats in some sense.
Okay. So now from things that are changing very quickly to things that are not changing very quickly at all, and by that I mean the conflicts in Ukraine and in the Middle East, and there's a lot of geopolitics stemming from those and other long-running conflicts in the world. How is this playing into global trade?
Yeah, so the geopolitical tensions, more broadly, mm-hmm. You know, they have some specific places where they are erupting, but in general, we see an increase in geopolitical tensions, especially between the large players, the US and China. And this has been a concern for the fund already for some time. And we have been talking quite a bit about the risks of geoeconomic fragmentation. What is this? This is in practice the fact that geopolitical tensions may lead to policies that de facto will break up the global economy and segment it across competing geopolitical blocks. Now, this is clearly not the objective of anybody, but it can just happen because of as a byproduct, as a reaction to what others are doing. Now, I think it's important to get the facts straight. So what the fund did, especially in the last couple of years, was investing a lot into understanding the cost of geoeconomic fragmentation. So what we did, and others, other institutions, other researchers did the same, was trying to quantify this cost. And this was done through a series of simulation exercises. And what we concluded, and the number that is cited very often, is that trade fragmentation will cost 7% of world GDP.
That's significant.
Now, there is obviously debate around these numbers, and there is debate about the assumptions, for instance, how we divided the countries in different blocks. I think this discussion risks to miss the bigger point. The bigger point is that there are two findings that come out from these studies that would remain independently of the assumptions. The first is the fact that more fragmentation you have, the higher will be the cost.
So nobody benefits essentially from fragmentation.
That's the second point, that overall the global economy loses from it, but the countries that lose more from it as a group are the developing countries. Now, in the discussion very often, and we can come back to this, we focus on the countries that are gaining from these tensions. Mm. But as a group, developing countries will lose. And there is a logic that is very simple to this. And it's the fact that large economies, the US, China, the European Union, they mostly rely on themselves. You know, they buy most of the products that they sell are the small economies that rely on external markets. So the reduction in the economies of scale that the fragmentation implies is mostly a negative story for developing countries. So the other point that I want to make is on the what we observe. These are simulations, so these are future scenarios that obviously we hope will not happen. The other aspect is monitoring what's actually happening. And, you know, some people are rightly skeptical, and they make the point that if you look at trade to GDP, even if we focus on goods, we see that this has been fairly stable in the past few years, roughly above 40%. So it's not been declining.
Okay.
But then if we look closer, we see that the policies that have been imposed, for instance, by the U.S. in China, starting with the tensions in 2018, they did have an impact. What these policies did was, for instance, reduce the share of U.S. imports from China in a few years by 8%. What they also did was substantially reallocate trade flows. A paper at the fund, I think, used a terminology that will be used quite a bit in the future, which is the rise of connector countries. These are countries like Vietnam or Mexico that have been importing more from China and exporting more from the U.S. And this happened in particular on the products that have been targeted by the tariffs. And this again shows how difficult it is in practice to affect global value chains and how difficult it is to decouple. And the third thing that we observe is that if we look at trade between countries that are geopolitically closer and trade between countries that are geopolitically more distant, there have been differences. And that the geopolitically distant countries have been trading relatively less with each other than geopolitically close countries. Again, this I think relates quite a bit to the policies and the changes in policies. Part of the story is obviously sanctions. Think of sanctions on Russia and the changes in the pattern of oil trade. But also the policies I was talking about earlier, the local content requirements that allow you to buy from certain trade partners in free trade areas and not others. So there are some cracks in the system that start to emerge.
So, finally, as the IMF's trade expert, how do we make the international trading system work better? And not only for companies looking to make profits, but for countries trying to build their economies?
So I think we need to, first of all, acknowledge that there are these three shifts. Second, we need to assess the risks. And third, we need to think what we can do better. So let me say something about each one of the shifts. We started with technology.
Yeah.
And there, I think the risk is twofold. The first one is that countries, and especially developing countries, do not really leverage technologies such as artificial intelligence, digital technologies, etc., for their growth and development. On the other hand, there is also a risk that the shifts in comparative advantage that we discussed earlier will create a group of losers that will resist the changes and will translate into more barriers. Mm-hmm. Now, on both, we can do quite a bit because we can do policy advice, advise countries on how to adopt the new technologies and better prepare for this. And something that I think the economics profession has not done sufficiently well is also think in terms of the policies, the domestic policies for adjustment. What are, for instance, the active labor market policies that we need to implement so that the transition from one occupation to the other is actually smooth? The second shift is the policy shift and the return of industrial policy. Here, again, the risk is very clear. Inefficiency, especially domestic inefficiency with government failures, and policy escalation. So what we need to do is, again, think more in terms of policy advice. What policy advice do we need? I think first we need to continue thinking about first best policies and institutions. We live in a second best world with many distortions in place, but there is still a role for first best policy and institutions. I think the example that I was giving earlier about developing countries and services exports would fall in that category. Mm-hmm. But then I think we need to do also something more. I think we need to distinguish between the better second best policies and the bad second best policies. Bad second best policies are the policies that are not very effective in achieving the goal that the government has, can be climate or other, and can be more distortionary. So we can differentiate them in order to give advice to governments on what direction they can take. We also need to think more in terms of the cooperative solution. This is to prevent the risks of policy escalation. The long-term objective would be to update the rule book on subsidies and possibly on industrial policies at the WTO. Mm. This is the house for trade rules. But an intermediate step would be to start a dialogue with the large players to have a common understanding of these trade and industrial policy issues and start developing some guidelines. Now, finally, the last shift is the geopolitical shifts and how to deal with the tension. There, obviously, the risk is the runaway fragmentation and the breakup of the global economy. Now, here, I think the key is that we need to continue to win the argument on the importance of cooperation.
Yeah.
There is a view that is becoming increasingly common that because this is a geopolitical world, it's like a zero-sum game. So whatever my rival is gaining, it's my loss. And then in this world, there is no need for cooperation. Mm. Now, that's clearly an incorrect view of the world, the zero-sum game. So more than incorrect, I would say it's very extreme. even when there are geopolitical tensions and geopolitical rivalry, there is still a role for cooperation. And the role for cooperation is clearly there because the policies that countries are imposing, being tariffs on others, reduce efficiency, which at the end of the day hurts everybody. So it's still the case that a rules-based system dominates a power-based system. So there, what we should do more is thinking what are the flexibility and adjustments needed in the system so that it can still function in a world where the geopolitical rivalries and tensions are more prominent.
Michele Ruta is a deputy head in the IMF's Strategy, Policy and Review Department. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You'll find much more about the IMF's work on trade at imf.org. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, which used to be Twitter, @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.